Ouais.
Few.
Ouais.
Some.
Bagisso.
And many.
On the tray, how many orange wool? How many orange wool?
Three.
Very good boy. Okay, we'll get you that nut.
So right now, he just chose the array that has the smaller number of elements, and he got a sugar pellet.
One, two, three, four.
Is this possibly the cutest experiment in numerical cognition?
Well, there's a lot of cute ones, actually. But yeah, lemurs are pretty beautiful creatures, so it's fun watching them.
Three, four, five, six.
Okay, last question. How many green block?
Four.
Good boy. Good parrot. Okay.
Three, four, five, six. Two, three, four, five, six, seven.
Numbers, they make the world go round. But how did humans come up with the concept of a number in the first place? In this programme, I'll find clues in the Brazilian Amazon where we meet a tribe with no words for numbers at all. We'll marvel at the numerical talents of our furry, feathered and even scaly friends. From this recent research, scientists are slowly understanding just what's going on in our brains when we count 1, 2, 3.
Indeed, there are evolutionarily ancient computational and representational systems that track number. And they are also innate in babies. We know that. And we also know how to characterize what they're like.
Let's start small. I used to have a tropical fish tank, and I never saw the appeal of the guppy with its flared tie-dyed tail. I take it all back. These small fish swim at the forefront of number research.
They like to swim in shoals, and that is a way of protecting the individual from predation.
Brian Butterworth, Emeritus Professor of Cognitive Neuropsychology at University College London.
This means it has to be able to choose between this shoal and that shoal, and it prefers larger shoals. And we've used that natural tendency to show that these little fish can discriminate between one fish on one side, two fish on the other, three fish on one side, four fish on the other, five fish on one side, eight fish on the other, and so on.
I wanted to know a little bit more about how you can measure guppy behaviour.
The subject, guppy, right, is in a transparent tank, and it can see two transparent tanks on either side. So it can see three guppies here and four guppies there.
And how do you judge what then? It goes to the glass,
yeah.
It puts its nose up, if fish have noses, yeah. Against the glass on the right side.
We have a criterion. If they get within, say, 10 centimetres on that side or 10 centimetres on the other side, then we say they've gone over to that side. But we've also done other experiments in which what you do is you train guppies to go for a larger array of abstract objects. So if they go over to, let's say, an array of four, where there's an array of three as well, and you feed them over the array of four, then they will learn to go over to the array of four, even if you change what the exact pattern is of the array of four. So they're learning something quite abstract.
I used to have guppies in my fish tank when I was a kid. I can't believe I didn't do all these mass experiments with them.
Well, the thing is, a lot of this work is very recent, and so nobody knew about the numerical abilities of fish until, I suppose, the last 7 or 8 years.
Fish cannot, yet, be trained to use computers, but lemurs can. So I flew to the Duke University Lemur Centre in North Carolina to meet psychologist Professor Liz Brannan.
This is a ring-tailed lemur that you're looking at right now.
Oh my God, it just jumped like 2 metres across the...
Yeah,
across the pen.
They are wonderful jumpers. The black and white striped tail looks kind of like a cross between a skunk and a monkey.
Like they've got incredibly delicate fingers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually one of the surprises for us when we first started working with them. They seem to be pretty dexterous and use their hands a lot, and yet when we introduced the touchscreen to them, they didn't use their hands much for responding. So you'll see that he uses his nose often to touch the screen instead of these little delicate hands. Yeah.
The lemur is Teres. Like a student sitting at a desk, he is crouched at the computer, nose poised to touch the screen when his number challenge begins.
We're trying to ask the question of whether he can tell the difference between two pictures based on the number of objects that are in each picture. And so we've trained him to choose the one that has the smaller number of circles in it first. and then touch the one that has the larger number of circles. And if he does that correctly, he gets a sugar pellet that automatically drops out right below the computer screen.
So what he's seeing is two squares, and each square has a certain number of dots, and he needs to touch the lowest one first. Basically touch the lowest one.
Exactly. So right now, he just chose the array that has the smaller number of elements, and he got a sugar pellet. Here he made a mistake and chose the one that had the larger number of elements.
So it's actually just like a game show. He gets a ping when he gets it right, exactly. And a kind of a low noise when he gets it wrong.
Right. So this lemur was initially trained with only images that had 1, 2, 3, or 4 dots. And we then expanded his test range to include these larger values. And he had no problem when the arrays had up to 9 dots in them in this case.
And even though he's making some mistakes here, when you test them over hundreds and hundreds of times, basically gets it right what percentage of the time, more or less?
So it depends on the ratio between the two quantities. So if it's a really great ratio, something like 1 dot versus 9 dots, he does exceedingly well, let's say something like 95%. But when there are two quantities that are close together, like 2 versus 3 or 8 versus 9, he does pretty poorly with those arrays.
Do you think that they are counting them, 1, 2, 3, 4?
Here it looks like what's happening is something more parallel, more all at once. Instead, he just seems to be kind of getting a gestalt of the two and choosing one of the two arrays.
Liz Brannan also studies other primates. In one experiment, she played a sequence of beeps to rhesus monkeys. The monkeys were then shown two pictures, each with a different number of dots, and they were able to point to the picture with a number of dots that had been beeped.
It's showing that they're really representing number abstractly, and even though they're perceiving it in a particular sensory modality, the representation is a step removed from that initial representation.
But they weren't always right. Their accuracy depended on the ratio between the two choices. They only had a primitive, approximate understanding of number.
The primitive number sense is our ability to represent number or think about number without language, not precisely the way we can with Arabic numerals, the way we can talk about that 1,000 and 1,001 are equally different from 1 and 2. Instead, our ability to represent number with the primitive number sense is all ratio dependent and approximate.
What does this tell us about humans and how we understand mass and numbers? Because presumably one of the objects of all this research is to try and find out like how math came about in the first place.
Right. Yeah, so that's one of the amazing things, that even though humans are capable of learning all sorts of complex symbolic mathematics that monkeys are never going to learn, that underlying this uniquely human symbolic mathematics is this primitive number sense. And so when you test monkeys and humans in the same tasks, you can strip away all of our higher order language-dependent mathematical abilities, and you can actually see that humans perform very similarly to monkeys. And so this suggests that even once we become symbolic mathematical processors, we still have simultaneously operating this primitive number sense. And so one of the questions that many of us are trying to answer right now is what role this primitive number sense plays in mathematics.
But is the primitive, approximate number sense the only number mechanism in our brains? No, there's a second system.
The approximate number system is one ancient system with numerical content, and it turns out we have another one. And we share this with other animals as well. And this is also innate in babies.
Susan Carey, professor of psychology at Harvard University.
So the approximate number system can represent approximately the number of individuals in quite large sets, up to the hundreds. But we have another system that keeps track of small sets of individuals precisely. Precisely 1, precisely 2, precisely 3.
The precise system is called subitization. It only works for 1, 2, 3 and sometimes 4. It is very fast and it doesn't involve counting.
When you count 1, 2, 3, it takes longer to count 3 than to count 1. if you could just do this yourself, make yourself a bunch of cards with either a single dot on them or a pair of dots on them or three of dots on them, mix them up, flash them down and just say 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1, et cetera. It's just as easy to do 3 as it is to do 2 or 1. You can just look at it and you see the threeness. That's subitization.
So the brain has two systems for tracking numbers, an approximate counting system for large numbers, and a quick system for recognizing precisely 1, 2, and 3. The question is, how do these two systems interact? And how do we build up to our modern understanding of numbers in which we can understand big ones precisely?
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
For Susan Carey, the clue is our ability to memorize ordered lists or count lists.
The way count lists represent number, it's a trick. It's easy for us and for even non-human primates to learn ordered lists. That's not a problem. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, A, B, C, D, E, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But at the beginning, those ordered lists are meaningless. Children don't have the slightest idea what Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday are, or it turns out what 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 are when they learn those ordered lists.
We're going to do counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 9.
Toddlers learn the words 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 without knowing what they mean. And then something happens. Ted Gibson, a cognitive scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Kids go through this amazing stage where they understand what one is and they don't understand what any of the others are. Those are called one knowers. They'll know what one is and not know what the rest are.
Look at my fingers. How many?
1, 14, 18, 14.
And then they go through a stage called when they know what two is, you know, one and two, and they can give you one and two, but then if you say three, they give you a handful, don't know again. And then they go through, there's three knowers who know 1, 2, and 3. Sometimes kids go through a four knower stage, but there's never a five knower stage, meaning there's no kid that knows 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and doesn't also know 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So somehow at around 4 or 5, they make this big leap. They figure out what this list is, this they figured out that, oh my goodness, that there's, you know, every time you add one, that's what's going on with this list.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Woohoo, we did it.
According to Susan Carey, this eureka moment for all of us springs from our innate understanding of 1, 2, and 3.
If you've got that ordered list, and you then figure out that 1 means 1, which is given to you by the subitizing system, 2 means 2, which is given to you by the subitizing system, and 3 means 3, since those numbers are related to each other by +1, the child is in the position to figure out the trick of how this system represents number, namely that you go up one more in the list, you're adding one to the set, and now, for the first time, you have a way of representing exactly 4, exactly 5, exactly 6, exactly 7. And so this external numeral list gives you precisely 7. That's an enormous conceptual advance.
We're able to do this because we have language and writing. We learn our count list, 1, 2, 3, with words and symbols, which makes us unique in the animal kingdom. Or does it?
How many green block?
4.
Good boy. Good parrot. Okay.
One of the most remarkable pieces of research in numerical cognition concerned ALEX. That's short for Avian Learning Experiment. ALEX was an African grey parrot who died prematurely in 2007, aged 30. He had learned to understand the words and the numerals for the numbers from 1 to 6. His owner, Dr. Irene Pepperberg, still works with parrots. At her Harvard lab, I met with her and a former lab mate of ALEX's, Griffin.
Yeah, oh, look at all these toys. Look at all these cool toys.
She was asking him some questions about objects in the lab.
Oh, tell me what matter? What matter? Wood, good boy. That's a good pick. Like I could get away without giving you a nut. What matter is this? What matter? Wool.
Wool, yes. It's a little woolen green pom-pom.
Okay, what matter?
Cork.
The birdie. Yeah, actually, why don't you bring over like a white, yellow, oak, C-U-P, and we can maybe do a color?
I mean, it's funny, the only other time I've had someone that spells something out is when there's a child in the room.
Yes,
so the child doesn't understand anything exactly the same.
Can you tell me what color?
Yellow.
Yellow, good birdie. Yes, you can have a nut. And then we'll ask you one more color, and then we'll be through with you. Okay, one more. One more. Can you tell me what color?
Orange.
Orange, good birdie.
Alex could tell colors and materials too. But more impressive were his numerical abilities. When shown a collection of six objects, he would say, six, or s. Well, you try saying six without lips. Irene was an unconventional math teacher.
So we learned three and four first. Then we taught him five and two, so one more and one less. And then six and one, again, one more and one less. And one was actually the hardest number to teach him because he already knew if there's one thing on the tray, you say key. You know, why do I have to say one key?
Okay, so you went from three objects and then two objects and then more objects.
Yeah.
How long did this take? And are you going in speaking to him for hours and hours every day over years, or is it something they pick up much quicker than that?
It wasn't just doing numbers. Remember, we do a lot of different things all at once in the lab. So while he was learning numbers, he was learning same and different. He was learning bigger and smaller. He was learning a lot of other concepts, okay, learning labels for bunches of new objects. So obviously it took several years, but it wasn't that we trained him on thousands of trials every single day.
And when did you start to realize that he was exceeding your expectations in those simple number tasks and was going to carry on breaking new ground?
We started giving him multiple sets of objects. So, for example, there were like three keys and two corks. And the fact that he could tell us the subset was a real breakthrough because young children have real trouble with that. They just want to tell you the total amount.
Here's a recording of Alex presented with a tray of objects with different colors and shapes.
On the tray, how many orange wool? How many orange wool?
Three.
Very good boy.
Nut.
Okay, we'll get you that nut. There you go. Can you tell me how many orange block? How many orange block? Very good. Okay, last question. How many green block? How many green block?
Four.
Good boy. Good parrot. Okay.
Once he had the words for numbers, Irene taught the parrot the Arabic numerals for them.
He knew that six blobs of something was six. The verbal, vocal six, and that was production and comprehension. We then trained him independently that this squiggle was also called six. We trained that. So the question now was, could he understand that because they both had the same vocal label, that this squiggle represented a set of things? So we tested him by putting two Arabic numbers on a tray and asking him what color was bigger or what color was smaller. So it would be like a green 5 and a yellow 2. What color bigger, what color smaller? He was right, very high statistical significance.
But it got even more interesting. Working with Susan Carey, Irene taught Alex the numbers 7 and 8. In fact, she taught him the words and the numerals without ever associating the numbers 7 and 8 with collections of 7 and 8 objects. Susan Carey takes up the story.
Then she taught him 7 is bigger than 6 and 8 is bigger than 7 without ever pairing those with any sets of 7 or 8.
In other words, he knows that 7 is bigger than 6. So what happened when he was presented with a collection of 7 objects for the very first time?
Now we gave him a tray for the first time with 7 blobs of something and asked him how many. And he looks at it and he waits for a second or two and goes 7.
He got the number right first time.
This is a wildly unwarranted induction. He only knows that 7 is bigger than 6 and 8 is bigger than 7. But every number that he's ever been taught in his 30 years was related to the other numbers he'd known by plus 1. And so he makes the very sensible induction. He, without ever hearing 7 paired with 7 elements. The first time she showed him a set of seven and said, how many? He said seven.
And we gave made things eight. Took off two, six. He understood it.
So he was deducing the amount from knowing the position of the number on the number line.
And no other non-human has done this. So this was incredibly exciting.
Do you think you were learning something about this one grey parrot, or you're actually learning something about pretty much all animals? It's just that you could only communicate with the one that had language.
Probably the latter. And the interesting thing about this is that giving these animals a symbol to represent the number, that's what lets them do this exact symbolic representation. They get it the same way that young children get it.
Alex showed the benefits of having words when learning the meaning of numbers. But not all human societies have number words. Like this one in the Brazilian Amazon. This is Piraha, a language spoken by about 700 people.
The Piraha live as semi-nomads, hunter-gatherers along the Maisi River of the state of Amazonas, Brazil. They're about as far from modern industrial society as one can imagine.
That's Daniel Everett of Bentley University, who lived with the Piraha first as a missionary and then as a linguistics researcher. He was particularly interested in their number words, or rather, the lack of them.
When I first went to the Piraha, it seemed that they only had numbers for one, two, and many, which is not that uncommon among the world's languages. But as I began to investigate this more systematically, it became fairly clear to me that they had no numbers whatsoever.
One of his first inklings came with observations like this.
If someone comes into the village with three fish, and two of the fish are very small, and one of the fish is very large, the people will call the very large fish the number that I thought meant two, and they'll call the two small fish the number that I thought meant one. And that was the first step to realizing that these are relative amounts, not precise numbers per se.
Proof came when Dan invited MIT cognitive psychologist Ted Gibson to a Piraha village to conduct a simple counting experiment.
We had a bunch of countable, identical things. We actually had spools of thread. That's what we happened to have, a bunch of these things, and they were familiar with them. So, and they were all identical. And then we'd put out one and say, what's this? And they'd say some word and the noun thread. And then put out another one and said, what's this? And they'd do the same thing and say this. And each person would only ever give those three quantifier words, which we thought were one, two, and many.
The first two words sound similar, but the language is tonal and the words are different. Anyway, Ted reversed the counting test, starting at 10 spools and taking one away each time.
What we found when we started at 10 and went down, by the time we get to around 5, actually, I think we started by 7, people would often start using the word we thought was 2.
Huh?
And then by the time you get to 4, everyone was using the word we thought was 1.
Huh?
So it's like relative to the context, what might be many can turn into few, because if you already had 5, now 4 is few. It's just few, some, and many. They're all relative terms.
Not only are they relative, but they're approximate. They do not refer to precise numbers. It's the same approximate number system that we saw in lemurs and monkeys.
One question that people would have is, how can you survive in a community without words for 1, 2, and 3? You know, we need 3 fish for supper or something like that.
They don't farm and they don't do well at trading, as you might expect. What they do, they hunt and they gather their food, and their food is actually pretty available. Fish is very available, and they hunt wild pigs and other kinds of animals from the jungle, and they do get some local fruits. But when you're distributing those to your family or to a group of families, and you kind of want to spread out the same amount to each person, it doesn't matter how many there are. What matters is how much stuff each person gets. Because say I catch three fish. Well, they're not the same. The fish are different. One fish might be very small. One of those might be very large. What matters is the volume. And so you have to sort of evenly distribute the volume, not the number of things. So there's no real reason to count objects.
How does discovering that there is a tribe that whose only number words are few, some, and many, mm-hmm. how does that help us understand how humans in general understand number?
It shows us that count words aren't innate. So it shows us that this is an invented, I would say, a discovered concept. So this is something we have to discover. The idea of there being exact count words is not something that we're born with. This is something that we have to discover, and then we can teach our young. That strikes me as incredibly interesting, that this is not a part of innate cognition, that this is something that we have to learn.
The Piraha have no words for exact numbers, and, says Ted, only understand numbers approximately. Yet this is a new research area, and academics have conflicting theories. Let's change continents. The remote Australian outback. The woman singing is a member of the Walpiri, an Aboriginal group who only have words for one, two, few, and many. A regular visitor here is neuropsychologist Brian Butterworth, he of the Guppies, who conducts experiments into how they count.
What we do is we show children some objects on a tray, and they have their own tray. Then we cover up our tray, and we ask them to put out as many objects as we had on our tray. Okay, so they're doing it from memory. And they can do that quite well. They get them right as much as kids who can count with words do. But we have another test, which is called cross-modal matching. So the idea of a number is that it's abstract. It doesn't matter whether it's three coins in the fountain, three wishes, or three chimes of Big Ben. So what we do is we make a number of noises. This is using very high technology. Two sticks, which we bang together. And what they have to do is they have to put out as many objects as we've banged sticks together. So we might bang three sticks together, and they have to put out three objects, or seven sticks together, and they put out seven objects.
And do they do that and get the answers right?
They're just as good as kids growing up with counting words in Melbourne. They have to have an abstract representation of numbers in their head.
What were you trying to find out with this experiment, and what do you think you established because of it?
One idea is that in order for you to be able to count the exact number of objects in a set, you need to have counting words. And I think what we've shown is that without counting words, you can still enumerate the number of objects in a set quite accurately. And this goes against a lot of theorists who think that they are necessary to have concepts of exact number beyond, say, three or four.
We'll leave the professors to argue about whether or not to have the abstract idea of seven, you need a word for seven. But whoever is right, our ability to understand exact numbers, like 423, is based on ancient evolutionary mechanisms in our brains. Research with the numberless, that's animals, babies, and indigenous peoples, is helping us understand what these mechanisms are. Numbers seem so simple, as easy as 1, 2, 3. Yet to invent or discover them took humans hundreds of thousands of years.
It took until 10, 12,000 years ago before anybody developed a way of externally representing numbers, either number words, counting words, or concrete symbols. It was invented once in Sumeria and probably spread from Sumeria 12,000 years ago slowly around the world. So why did it take so long for humans to come up with this symbolic or external method of representing numbers? I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's an interesting question.